This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Somewhere in the Bible, Understanding Bible Scripture and Creation, and the author, Harris F. Allen. Harris, thank you for joining us.
Oh, hello, Steve. Thank you for inviting me. I've been looking forward to it today.
Well, this is a special interview on Indie Book Publishing brought to you by Wespo Press.
That's correct.
Well, Harris, I'm going to read a couple of things that you've written just to kind of set the stage for our discussion. You say this: the Holy Bible is a true historical recording of events in human history.
That's correct.
Modern science attempts to avoid the Bible under the guise of it being a non-repeatable event. And, of course, you say, and that's a good thing.
Right.
And ages of Earth and its contents have been wildly exaggerated, and science is avoiding the first and foremost recording of human origins. So you take issue with a lot of things that are advocated by science.
That is correct, Steve. I see that evolution seems to be taught in our schools and our universities, or it's certainly adhered to. And I find that there's never been a single shred of credible evidence that's ever been produced, only imaginary fabrications. There is no proof of evolution whatsoever. Now, there's been lots of scientific work in the laboratory. That science has concluded just the opposite proof, the proof that evolution is completely and undeniably impossible. A scientist, including geneticists, has gone through millions and millions of life cycles with various lab specimens. Their goal is to find a mutation or a genetic change that could be beneficial to the species. The results have been consistent. No help for evolution whatsoever. They've gone through all these millions of life cycles. And when a mutated specimen does survive, it's usually harmed by the mutation. And evolution calls for survival of the fittest. That part I will agree with. But survival of the fittest would eliminate a mutated species. And in spite of all the scientific work, there's never been a manipulation that made a species stronger. It's never been stronger than the parent form. There's also, needless to say, there's never been a species to cross over into another species. The real question that needs to be asked, in my opinion, if there's any truth at all to evolution, if it's at all possible, why not have some real evidence instead of so many imaginary fabrications? If any credible evidence had ever existed, it should have already been presented. Instead of real evidence, we'll have imaginary drawings and various fabrications or hoaxes. If any listeners would like to see some of the things that we may mention here, or things that are mentioned in my book, all that's needed is to go to the internet and browse under evolution hoaxes or frauds or fakes.
Well, why don't you tell us about some of those hoaxes, frauds, or fakes?
Well, certainly, I'd like to mention a few that come to mind. Now, they won't be in any particular order, but I think we'll definitely see a pattern here. I can think of the first one as an early 1800s biologist by the name of Ernst Haeckel. That's spelled H-A-E-C-K-E-L. Now, he became famous as an embryologist, and his drawings of embryos were featured in textbooks all over the world. And, of course, there would be no reason for a student to doubt the accuracy of a textbook because it was being taught in schools and universities. And some of his fake drawings are even persistent today. He drew hundreds of embryos, but let's choose a few for diversity. For instance, he drew a fish, chicken. human, and a dog, and hundreds of more. But he could draw his embryos side by side and make them all the same size. Now, that was a deception, because we all know that a fish embryo and a human embryo are not going to be the same size, and they're not going to look identical. He carefully put in all similarities, but he also carefully omitted any unique features. So that was another deception. Okay, according to his intent, and according to early 19th century science, those embryos could have been, in those days, people didn't know better, they could have been interchangeable. The fish embryo could have become a puppy or a human. The ape embryo would look like a carbon copy of the human embryo, and that's exactly what Haeckel intended. Okay, thankfully science has moved away from that, and they know how embryos look now. I mean, actually, they take photographs of embryos. We don't have to depend on sketches any longer. But populations back in the 19th century were really only a few centuries removed from spontaneous life theory, and then the germ theory came after that. Now, the next guy I could mention is Darwin, so I'll mention him, but he's well known as an evolutionist. And what people may not realize about Darwin is he plagiarized his work from Alfred Russel Wallace, who printed it first. And he and Darwin, they communicated for a while so that he could clarify, Wallace could clarify his ideas. And Darwin took them and published them and took credit for it. Anyway, that's enough about him. But it was a fabricated hoax that comes to mind. And this one was called Piltdown Man. Have you heard about that one, Steve?
I haven't. Tell us.
Okay, you haven't heard about Piltdown. Well, there is a gravel pit in Sussex, England, by the name of Piltdown. So that, and that's where it was found. And that gravel pit is known as a treasure trove for geologists and others that seek fossils and skeletal remains, because there's thousands or maybe millions of animal remains accumulate there, and they seem to have been deposited by a huge flood at some point in time. Well, there was some certain remains that came from that pit and went into a museum display in 1912. It was called the Missing Link. Okay, he was displayed in museums throughout the world. That display traveled all over the world for 40 years. Millions of people read the message and looked at the display. Now, if we're looking at a display, and we see that little sign that says Steps of Evolution, and this is the missing link, we're going to believe it. Millions of people did.
Right.
Millions of people still did. But Piltdown was exposed as a hoax in 1953. But after 40 years, the damage was already done. The millions of people that believed it then didn't believe it was a hoax. And even people that should know better still believe it. Okay, the hoax was determined to be part of a human skull that was glued to the jawbone of an orangutan with teeth filed down.
My goodness.
He had teeth carefully filed down to try to match human. And they'd both been stained. They were different colors, so they'd both been stained with the same color, so they'd be exact in color. Well, that 40 years of deception would never, ever be erased. It still persists. Okay, I mentioned Piltdown Man, so that makes Piltdown Bird come to mind. Have you heard about that one?
Not. I haven't. Tell us about Piltdown Bird.
Well, let me tell you, this one was featured in National Geographic, and it's not that long ago, November 1999. A huge article entitled Feathers for T-Rex, and had an artist to draw a picture of what the bird would have looked like if it had been real. That was proof that dinosaurs evolved or devolved into birds, and it was given a scientific name of Archaeoraptor. Sounds great. It was later found to be parts and pieces of a variety of animal skeletons glued together and attached to a small extinct dinosaur tail. Still, with National Geographic's widespread exposure, that fake was so impressive that many still believe today that birds evolved from dinosaurs. Even a few scientists believe it so badly that they're out there trying to prove it now. left, again, an indelible impression, intentional, fake impression, the irreversible damage, so it'd been done. There are a lot more fakes out there, Steve. I'd like to mention Nebraska Man. I know we need to move on here. I'd like to mention several others. Nebraska Man was just a portrait. It was nothing but a portrait painted from the imagination of an artist. It was painted from a single tooth. And the tooth, when it was matched to the rest of the skeleton, happened to be from an extinct pig. So we didn't start out with anything except a portrait picked up by the London News and spread around the world. Okay, now then, Steve, have you heard about the one named Lucy?
I have.
You've heard about Lucy. Okay, you know that she was billed as the first human being that ever walked the earth way before Adam and Eve. Well, she was named Lucy, and she was famous for a while. She had her 15 minutes of fame because most of the world heard about her. Science's final conclusion after they found more parts of her skeleton was that her fingers and toes were made for climbing. The final scientific conclusion on Lucy was that she was a small ape or a chimp that probably died of old age. So I'm going to close out the hoax subject just by saying to the listeners, anybody that wishes to study the subject a little more, just place evolution hoaxes in your internet browser. You should find a few that we've been able to mention here, plus a lot more.
Now, DNA has become a valuable tool for science.
Oh, absolutely correct, Steve. Researchers have worked with DNA for many decades now. We're both aware of that, even way before the genome sequencing was completed. Now, they've tried vainly to produce varying results through millions of life cycles, as I mentioned. And the results have always been the same, but certainly not encouraging for any possibility of evolution. But the work has provided some vital knowledge about DNA compatibility, and that's very important. Each species has a unique DNA that is incompatible with DNA from all other species. We now know that. We know that some amino acids have to link together to form DNA. We also know it's more complicated if you get into polypeptide linkage and so forth. A lot of biochemistry here, but I'll try to keep it simple. There's three nucleotides involved. They're called codons, and they're the ones that decide which amino acid is next in a sequence of protein synthesis, or the building of protein. This is not new knowledge, Steve. It was taught when I was in college over 50 years ago. Now, I don't claim I learned it well, but I passed a few tests. The point is, there's now proof that those amino acids cannot link together in the presence of oxygen. They cannot link together in the presence of oxygen, yet oxygen must be there for DNA to live and replicate. Now, that is a question that evolution cannot answer. But if we go back to the Bible, in Luke and Genesis chapter 1, verses 21 and 24, those verses each mention a key phrase, very important. We get right back. Each after its own kind.
Right.
Each after its own kind. So that we get right back to the basic fact that Genesis got it right. Only the supreme creator could overcome those problems. Evolution has no answer for that, not even a guess or a reasonable theory.
Harris, we have a couple minutes left. We have to talk about Noah and all those animals on the ark. How could one man's family get all those animals on board?
Well, Steve, God knew that that ark was going to be on board for over a year, and it's probably closer to a year and a half. There wouldn't be any need in carrying adult animals. Young, healthy animals would probably be the choice. And personally, I believe God laid his hand on those young animals, similar to the description given in Ezekiel, later in that book of the Bible. To clarify my thinking on that, some listeners might like to refer to that passage about God's words to Ezekiel. Again, that's Ezekiel 4, chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. We think of the animals as coming in pairs only, but if we go back and clarify that with Genesis chapter 7, verses 2 and 3, we'll find that God ordered Noah to carry those animals in sets of seven pairs of clean animals and two pairs of unclean. That leaves a lot of animals. But if we go to verse 9 in the same chapter, it tells us God sent those animals to Noah two by two. And that's the reason we have the impression that there was two of everything. That's true, they came in pairs, but there were a lot more animals than we ever thought. But as far as taking care of them, as I mentioned, I believe God laid his hand on those animals and caused them to pair up and march in pairs to the ark. Once aboard, then the young animals would go into a virtual hibernation for the duration of the flood. The eight humans on board, there was Noah and his wife, their three sons, and their wives. So there was eight adult humans on board, and they could easily manage those young animals that were in virtual hibernation. And according to the dimensions of the ark, they'd have plenty of space with the room to spare.
Well, Harris, we appreciate you being with us. His book is titled Somewhere in the Bible, Understanding Bible Scripture and Creation. Harris F. Allen. Harris, tell us how to get your book.
Oh, well, it is now available through practically all major retailers. When I wrote the book, I knew that I should go ahead and make this as attractive as possible, so I bought a return policy guarantee so that all retailers can stock at any book retailer. So I don't have a preference, just so that I can get my message out to everybody. I'd love for everybody to read it, even if you can just borrow it from a friend.
Well, Harris, thanks for being on Indie Book Publishing in this segment, this special interview brought to everyone by Westbow Press. Thank you, Harris.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Steve. I've enjoyed it.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready for the Not-So-Soccer Mom Tuesday afternoons at 1 Eastern, noon Central on TogiNet with Jill Hickey. You name it, from politics to pop culture to Jill's search for the perfect bronzer and chicken salad. The Not-So-Soccer Mom will weigh in on it all. The sentence, "I have no opinion about that," is one that Jill has never uttered. In the early 90s, Jill finally decided to put her thoughts, opinions, mom advice, love of pop culture, hummus, and Starbucks, working out, cosmetic shopping, and politics into an actual website, and thus NotSoSoccerMom.com was born. Shortly after her fourth child, a boy, Jerome, now she's really got tons of topics to share with you. This is Laugh Out Loud Funny, and we're not kidding. What's a loud Nebraska girl who lived in Little Rock for many years and now is up in the Northeast doing? Chronicling her opinions on everything. The wheels aren't off yet, but it's close. It's the Not-So-Soccer Mom with Jill Hickey, Tuesday afternoons at 1 Eastern, noon Central, on TogiNet.com. Innovation and insight, problems and solutions, capitalizing on your ideas and efforts. That's all a part of Changing the World One Invention at a Time with Rick Rowe. Thursday evenings at 6, 5 Central on TogiNet.com. Rick will be sharing stories of innovation, invention, inspiration, and overcoming obstacles with guests who have been there, done that, and are doing that. Rick will be asking the right questions, helping you identify the real problems, and showing you how to act on your ideas by increasing consumer confidence, and more importantly, increasing your confidence to act on your ideas. For even more information, go to ThinkTech, that's T-E-K, globally.com. Then join us as Rick and his guests teach us how to develop new ideas and create new products, new businesses, new jobs. And together, let's get our economy growing again. It's Changing the World One Invention at a Time with author and inventor Rick Rowe. Thursday evenings at 6, 5 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Learning Journey, Absorbing Life's Lessons. And the author is June W. Lamb. And June joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This segment brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, June.
Good morning.
Well, congratulations. This is the type of book that really gets down to lessons about life that we all need to hear and ponder and get some better view of what's going on in our own lives. And you've been through it. That's what's great about this. This isn't just some theoretical kind of of writing. This is based on experience, and we'll get into that in just a moment. But let me first read some things you have written just to set the stage for our discussion. You say this: "The learning journey compels the reader to see his or her own journey through life as a climb toward consciousness and survival. This gripping true story of one person's successful struggle to survive tragic and chaotic challenges can lead others to an examination of childhood scripts and a recognition of their own value system based on their life experience. Combining psychological and spiritual wisdom, June Lamb gives guidance and inspiration to those willing to step into the classroom called life as they explore what it means to be human." Well, congratulations, June.
Well, thank you. It was a long time in coming, but I think that that's the key, is you have to live a lot to learn a lot.
Well, well said. So tell us about living. Give us some of your background and your personal experiences that led you to this point to publish your book.
All right. As it says in the book, I'm 85 years old. So I've lived in a century where there's been extraordinary change, extraordinary growth, extraordinary development of technology and everything. So it's required a lot of adapting to this. And I came out of a very traditional childhood and did the very traditional things. So it was really somewhat of a surprise to me that in the middle of my life, or what we used to call the middle, I don't believe old age starts till 70 at this point, but or 80, I discovered that I had to question a lot of things I had been taught and the ways I saw the world, because they weren't fitting into what I was experiencing. And I find that's true for a lot of people. And I have the privilege of working with people on a very intimate level as a licensed psychotherapist, where we share our feelings about those things, and we have the temerity to question authority. That's always been something we've accepted, and it's been quite a journey.
Well, it's a journey not only through one husband who died after 14 years of marriage that had a cancer, right?
Right.
And then you were trained as an expert secretary, and here at 52, you go back to school, and at 56, you get your license as a family therapist, so that cancer patients and their families can get insurance coverage, which they haven't been able to up to that point.
That's right. It was very, very difficult for us, because at the time that my husband's cancer occurred, which was in 1958, the medical model was still very, very focused only on the patient. And it's only been in the succeeding years that they realized how important the whole family system is in supporting the patient, and how directly affected the whole system is when there is a life-threatening illness or a death or whatever. So now I'm happy to say that the medical model and the psychological model have kind of combined to make the model far more effective.
And I have to tell everyone, and I'm sure everyone is feeling this as they're listening to you, you can't be 85. You sound like a young lady in her 20s or 30s.
I would credit that partly to genetics, but also it's part of, I practice what I preach. I do a lot of relaxing. I don't hold on to negative emotions for any length of time, but I don't deny that I have them. And so most people give an awful lot of their life energy to negative feelings or unresolved conflict or just a resistance to what's happening. And, you know, that takes our life energy. So I think part of my youthfulness, and I do swim laps, and I do all follow all the rules. There are rules that we don't always follow, but I find that the rules of cause and effect are pretty dependable.
Now, you talk about these rules, the laws of cause and effect. What are they?
Well, they exist at all four levels of life. You have a physical life, a mental life, an emotional life, and a spiritual life. And those laws are present in every one of those parts of your life. The physical laws are pretty easy to see. You can't jump out of a 10-story building and go up. You can't jump in front of a racing, speeding train and keep your physical body. But people have a little more difficulty seeing how absolute and how very, very helpful the laws are at the mental level, and that would be you can't make up your mind about something and never be open to looking at it differently. And the old man sitting in front of the cigar store saying, "By cracky, that horse is the fastest thing on the road," it'd be really outdated and not really fully involved in life these days when we have jet airplanes and everything else. So at the mental level, the law means you have to be willing to keep learning and taking in new information and throwing out the old rusty rules that you started with that maybe don't apply anymore. At the emotional level, it's very important to know that if you have negative emotions like guilt or resentment or anger, and if you hold on to those, you're constricting your blood vessels, you're making your heart work harder, you're not getting enough oxygen. See, those are just laws. You can't change those. So the result of understanding that is that you process your emotions and you don't hang on to them for any length of time to the point where they make you ill or cause you to age much faster than you need to.
You also talk about childhood scripts. Now, what are these?
A child is looking for authority, and a child is under authority, and a child doesn't have the power to make decisions. So you collect, as you go through childhood, you're told certain things are right and certain things are wrong. You're given rules on how you behave, like if you're going to get emotional, leave the table, or don't ever trust anybody, or, you're told things, and the child has nothing with which to gauge the truthfulness of that, so they accept it. So all of us come out of childhood with a script about life and a perception of life, and it's not a gene. So we genetically inherit our physical bodies and our possibilities, but we also accept the belief system and the view of life that that family might have. And so very often a physical illness is running through a family, but not because of a gene, because of an attitude, because of the way they see life, because their attitude constricts their body or causes them to have back aches or whatever. So they found out that the genetic factor doesn't have quite as much influence as they used to think. In fact, the research that I've looked at says it only is 20% of the causal factor as to what happens to us.
So that's why you say we always have choices in how to respond to challenge.
That's right, but usually it's only if we're willing to challenge those early childhood beliefs. But a lot of people don't want to do that. It means leaving the familiar way that you're living and seeing life and being without any ground to stand on, perhaps for a little while, but then developing a new view that jibes with your own experience in adulthood.
It's so easy to feel like a victim.
It sure is.
But you put it, victims are volunteers. We have a choice.
We do. We do. And so many people, and being a victim requires a lot of energy. You feel depressed. You feel fearful. You feel angry. Victimization is uses a lot of emotional energy. So when I felt victimized by my belief that if I was a good girl, God would take care of me, and it didn't happen that way, I went through a period of anger and resentment, and I was pretty brittle for a little while until I realized that it was still under cause and effect, that we always have a disease, almost always have had a disease we can't cure. There was the Black Plague and consumption and polio, and now we have so many forms of cancer, and we're trying so hard to discover the genesis of the different cancers and what to do for them. And this is all under law. You know, carcinogens didn't just pop up. We have helped create a lot of them. So that's been a big part of my growth, is in understanding the seeking what the laws are. You know, and then there are miracles, and I believe that miracles are just things we don't understand yet, but I certainly welcome them.
Now, you look at life in a very different way than most people. You just see it as a classroom.
I do.
Boy, that's a healthy thing. Why don't people see it that way? Why do we just, you know, want to point fingers and blame and all the above?
Well, I think we just have never had the opportunity to look at it that way. I see my office, and even though I'm a licensed psychotherapist, I see anybody that walks in my office, they're simply a student of life. So I don't consider I deal with mental illness. I put mental illness in the same frame of laws of cause and effect. And, you know, I know it exists, but still, I think everyone has the capacity to transcend and transform whatever has created the state they're in. In other words, change is inevitable. Without it, we're dead. We're just stuck. So I just feel that you don't want to learn a lot of these lessons. I would rather not have lost my fiancé in the Battle of the Bulge. That was my first experience with the permanence of death. But, you know, at this point in life, and having gone through other deaths and having helped other people and worked with hospice, now I'm really glad I got in that classroom early, because I don't fight it, and I know how to work through it. I know the process of grief. So it's a classroom, and people just aren't told that. They're told, you know, by authorities in their childhood or through their church or their political beliefs or something, they're told this is the way it is. So they don't develop their own center that is strong enough to ask the questions. And, you know, I had to withdraw authority from some pretty high authorities like doctors and ministers and people who were highly educated when I wasn't very educated. But you can't get your own center and your own view of life and your own, create your own soul journey, unless you are willing to look at it as a learning journey.
Why do people think they can make people change?
Because they don't like the way they are.
I'll make you change.
Yes.
Right.
And really, that's one of the greatest things that happens in the therapy setting, because whether it's marriage counseling or a family dynamic with an adolescent that they can't control or whatever, you cannot force another person to change. And very often, by demanding that they change, you simply make them stronger in whatever they're doing. So I think it's a misuse of power, or a misuse of our own value system. You know, I like people who think about what they're doing. Well, if I run across somebody who never seems to think about much, I have to accept that, because if I stand there and say, now think about what you're doing, I may make them be even more careless. And so I know that beginning to interact with them where they are rather than where I want them to be is really the only way you can have any effect. And you can't depend on them changing. We plant seeds. We plant seeds by our own modeling. And if we're not doing that, you know, I have an idea that teenagers develop a switch right on the top of their head, and when they get to be in that adolescent period of developing their own ego state, they just flip the switch and nothing goes in either ear. So parents might just as well stop talking.
Yes.
You know, if they're not modeling.
Modeling, setting the example.
Well, the parent who wants their child to be quiet, respectful, easy to be around, and yet when that parent gets upset, they yell at the top of their lungs. Or
nobody's listening then, right?
Nope. The child feels like they're in control. They're like the puppeteer.
Right. Yeah.
And they know how to push the buttons.
Well, June, we appreciate all your insight and all your wisdom and all your just a great life of experience. Again, we can't believe that you're 85 young years of age, so congratulations. And congratulations on your book, The Learning Journey, Absorbing Life's Lessons, June W. Lamb. June, tell us how to get your book.
Well, it's on all over the Internet, but I also have my own website, and that's just www.JuneWLamb, all one word, .com, and so you can read parts of the book there.
Oh, great.
You can also order it there, but it's on all the book-selling sites on the web. So, and it will be in the bookstores. It's only been in print for about 4 weeks, so they're getting it.
Thank you, June. Thanks for being on Indie Book Publishing. This segment brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com.
Youth was sad, right? Cause he had a death dear mommy and dad, right? But that ain't the case, nope. It wasn't his fate, nope. The ones never struggled to communicate, ha. Y'all wave your hands, look who's on, yep. It's Dakota Man Keith. Number one.
It's That Keith Wine Show on TogiNet.com, Wednesday nights at 8, 7 Central. Every week, That Keith Wine Show will have guests that share their experiences, expertise, opinions, and personal lives with us to hopefully help us better understand others. The topics and guests will come from the American Sign Language community. For more on Keith Wine and the show, go to his website, KeithWine.com. Listen with an open mind and willingness to learn and help with the cultural bridge.
Number one. Keith's number one. Everybody clap because the Dakota man's on. Number one. Keith's number one. Everybody clap because the Dakota man's on.
Don't miss That Keith Wine Show. Wednesday nights at 8, 7 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The President's Angel, Divine Intervention Series, Book 1. And the author is Carla Bruce, and Carla joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this special interview brought to you by Westbow Press. Hello, Carla.
Hi.
Well, you're going to take us on quite a journey. We just love it. The what-if journey, right?
Yes, it is. yeah.
Let me just read a few things that you've written. What if an angel of God appeared to someone in the 21st century with a message similar that was given to Gideon in the Old Testament times? And what if that someone had just been elected president of the United States? Well, it's the story of a man's rediscovery of faith. And this junior senator from Wyoming, Drummond Wakefield, he's got a big surprise coming, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Yeah, he's got a real wake-up call.
A real wake-up call. You know, 3 days after winning the election by a close margin, and there's a real twist in that, and we'll talk about what happened, twist is, he and his team fly to the family ranch in Wyoming to rest and begin forming his administration, and then the unexpected miraculous happens. So why this approach, Carla? What motivated you to write this series? We want to emphasize, this is book one. There are three books in the series.
That's correct, yes.
So tell us about a little bit about your background and why you chose this approach.
When I really committed my life to Christ when I was, well, many years ago, I suddenly had ideas that I felt were worth writing down. You know, I didn't come into this with the journalism degree and a great desire to write a novel or anything else. But that was just seemed to be part of the package that came, you know, with my commitment to Christ. And I found myself in a church where they were trying to start a magazine and work with some of the pastor stuff, and I began to edit and to ghostwrite in that area, and it seemed like that part of my work just took off. And I kept, you know, wanting to do my own thing, but there never seemed to be time for it. And so I've always loved to read novels, read fiction, but I was working all the time with nonfiction, and I thought, how neat if I could take these Bible principles that I worked with for so many years and put them into story form. And that was my desire. And I know that stories can prepare the heart to receive truth in another form. They can reach people who perhaps would not read a nonfiction book or would not listen to a sermon, but they might read a good story. And so that was the beginning. As to why I chose the idea of an angel and a president, all I can say is the idea dropped into my, wherever it drops into, my spirit, my mind, my heart, many years ago, and it wouldn't go away. It's not that I had, you know, thought I had, well, I have a message that I want to deliver. That's never been the case. It's that I have a story I want to tell. And so I toyed around with it for a while and realized I didn't have the skills to write fiction. And took some classes, workshops, read some books, finally was able to really work on the book, and that's pretty much the background there.
And you have a hope that leaders of the nation could rise above the political squabbles that, of course, we're all watching right now, and it's going to get even, you know, crazier and crazier as we get closer to the election and all the hateful attacks. This has a whole different approach.
Yes. Well, views, those are what I would like to see. And you know, I can create my own world and my own president.
Right.
And that's what I did. But I really believe all it would take would be for one man or woman in a position of national prominence to take a stand and say no more. Just say, I am going to run a positive campaign. I don't care what anybody else does. I think the response of the people in this nation would be so tremendous that it could change the tide of the very ugly tide of politics as we see it now.
So this one is set at a time just before the political convention, the national convention, and the candidate for president, he's all chosen. It's going to be a sweep, isn't it? They just know this candidate is just going to win big.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, that was, see, I had to have, my character could not be the, he couldn't have this great desire to be the president. He couldn't have all the motivation and all the political machinery behind him. I don't think the storyline would have worked that well.
Right. So here's the candidate ready to sweep the election, and right on the eve of the party's convention, what happens?
He dies.
Just a minor thing.
Minor thing. Yeah, I think the first word of the book is, dead? What do you mean dead?
Massive heart attack.
Right. Yeah.
And so now the scramble.
Right.
The scramble, and there's this junior senator. Tell us about Drummond Wakefield from Wyoming.
Right. And why Wyoming, someone might ask. Well, one reason, I love Wyoming. We vacation there often, but it has, the Mountain West has a certain aura about it. You know, it's he's not going to be presented as the big city type man, even though he's intellectual and, you know, very well read and everything. But it portrays more a rugged individual. Just the very state of Wyoming itself. At least it does to me. And that's why I chose that setting. Plus, it's a beautiful, beautiful to write scenery about.
So he is stunned when someone approaches him late at night, right after the death of the other candidate. He is stunned.
Yes. Yeah, he is. He, you know, it's like, you know, what's this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Me?
And
you got to be kidding me.
Right. Yeah. Playing with his emotions, it was really it was a fun thing to write, you know, to try to feel what he must have been feeling.
So off he goes. They go off to Wyoming to, of course, this is after the campaign, right? He wins.
Yes, he wins.
He wins.
Not by a landslide, but he does win.
He does win, and so now they're relaxing in Wyoming. And he goes off by himself, kind of rides away to savor the beauty and the tranquility of the Wyoming vista. And then to most people, you know, this is the incomprehensible happens.
Right.
Tell us about what happens.
Okay.
Set the stage for us. Give us the scene.
Okay. He's on the top of a... Well, not so much the mountain, but anyway, a high ridge. And it's a place he's always gone to when he wants to just be by himself, and even when he was a kid, he went up there. And he's sitting here, and he nods off to sleep, and all of a sudden, you know, there's this bright light. And he thinks it's a nuclear explosion, you know, and he's waiting for the blast, and it doesn't come. And then the hair stands up on his on the back of his neck and on his arms. And it's just like there's this eerie silence. Nothing, there's no breeze, there's not a sound. Then all of a sudden, right in front of him materializes this being. It's the angel, but he's not sure what it is yet, you know.
So. Yeah, that would, I'm sure all of us would go through all levels of emotion and
you know,
and trying to figure out, I must be sleeping, I must be dreaming, right?
Yeah.
And a little bit of anxiety and maybe even some fear.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. I think at one place he kind of backs up with his, you know, against the ledge there with his hands just planted beside it, like, I can't get away from this guy.
Because he's not really, at that moment in time, he isn't that, how would you describe his spirituality, his religious dedication?
He had accepted Christ as a young man, but had lived most of his life as if God really wasn't a part of his everyday, you know, life. He hadn't been to church in years. He was still basically a good man at heart, but God just wasn't a factor in his life.
So, what does the angel tell him?
He tells him that God has a message for him, you know, and that he has a role to play in the restoration of godly values, or godly and biblical values in our country, many which have been lost or in danger of being lost. And, you know, and he, I think he responds with, you know, what do you mean, me? Don't you, you know, I've already got a big job to do, you know. But, yeah.
How does he leave that event, this incredible, never-to-be-forgotten event in anybody's life? He goes away from that with, what is he feeling, what is he thinking?
He's stunned would probably be speechless, stunned.
Why me?
Yeah.
Well, you're the president.
Yeah. And I'll, you know, even second thoughts. Well, maybe I dreamed it. No, I didn't dream it. Maybe I'm hallucinating. Not good if I'm going to be president, you know. So still a lot of turmoil there. And, you know, what am I going to do now? And eventually he remembers his, well, he doesn't remember her, but he thinks of his Aunt Carrie, who becomes his spiritual mentor in the book. And she's the one who took him to Sunday school and church when he was a young boy. And he goes to her and tells her what has happened to him. He feels like this is the only person he could talk to about it. And she gives him some sound advice. And, I think one of the things the angel told him to do was to put out a fleece like Gideon did to, you know, to determine if this was true or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so instead of a sheepskin, he puts out a cowhide. And that was a fun scene to write, too. You know, one of the challenges of the book was getting him away from his Secret Service agent to do something sneaky by himself. You know,
right.
You really had to work at that. You know, he goes
to make it real, just to make it real.
Yes,
right, for everyone.
Yeah. He goes into the barn after midnight one night, and you know, he forgets to take a flashlight, so he's feeling around because he knew his father had always put up a cowhide from each year's Roundup. You know, so he finds one. Takes it out in the middle of the hay field and, you know, does his thing. Feels very foolish doing it, but also pretty much compelled to do it anyway.
He's got to know.
Yeah, that's it. He has to know.
Well, like anybody, you would have to be somehow just reassured totally.
Yes, yeah.
Because who knows, maybe he was dreaming, and maybe it's all just in his mind. He's so overwhelmed about being president. Well, now how does he share? Does he ever share this with his wife?
Yes, he does. Yeah. He puts out two fleeces, just like Gideon did. And now his wife knows, hey, something's going on with my husband. He's not acting normally, you know, and he won't talk to her. He won't tell her what's going on, and she keeps nagging at him and pushing him, and he doesn't like being pushed, and you know. He has to resolve this first. But after both fleeces and the angel comes back to him after the second fleece and after he's made a renewed commitment to God, you know, as an adult, not that he needs to accept Christ again, but he has to renew that commitment, fully conscious of all that is at stake now with what he knows.
And, of course, with this increased spirituality, always comes opposition, and the opposition escalates and culminates even with an attempt on his life. So it's a wild ride for Drummond and for the reader.
Yes. One of the opposition, the guy that died at first, the shoe-in candidate, he was aligned with some kind of an underground consortium he was in their pocket, okay? And so these people are still out there, and they're trying to find ways to accomplish what they want to do, even though that man is gone. And with Drummond's, with his approach to wanting to, well, he says he wants to be upfront, honest, and, you know, above board in all of his dealings, which, you know, would be a real novelty. But this creates, you know, some of the opposition.
Certainly, certainly.
Yeah.
The drama of the daily newscast that we watch every day.
Today. Yeah, yeah. People keep telling him, well, that's the way the game is played.
Right,
and he says, you know, it's not a game.
Not anymore. Not with this.
No, it's not a game, and I refuse to play it if it is. And so, you know, people just, they don't know what to make of him. They don't know how to respond to him.
The title of the book, The President's Angel, Divine Intervention Series, Book 1. The author is Carla Bruce. Carla, tell us how to get your book.
It's available from Westbo. It's on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. A person could go to their local bookstore. It won't be on the shelves, at least not yet, but you can special order it. I know some people who have done that. They could even get in touch with me. I have a box or two here.
Okay. Well, thank you for being with us on Indie Book Publishing, Carla. This interview brought to everyone by Westbo Press. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you, Steve, for making it an enjoyable experience.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.